Welcome in! Latest episode of that SEC podcast. I'm your host, Michael Bratton. Go by SEC Mike on the Twitters, and there he is, our great friend, Stephen Lassen, the senior editor over at Athlon Sports. Stephen, how are you? And Merry Christmas to you and the cousins.
Merry Christmas to you, Mike. Merry Christmas to the cousins. Hope everybody enjoyed the playoff games this weekend. Excited to get another week of bowl season. Don't forget, if you're trying to escape those pesky in-laws or you want to wrap some presents and get away from the family, the Hawaii Bowl is on December 24th night, so you can escape. But otherwise, Mike, like I said, Merry Christmas. Excited to talk some ball with you after a fantastic weekend of games.
I don't even know who is in that Christmas Eve bowl game, Stephen.
Mike, it is Hawaii.
Okay.
Playing in its home stadium, playing California. So we got two ex-Hawaii quarterbacks. If you played NCAA back in the day, Nick Rolovich and Timmy Chang were like, you know, superstars on the PlayStation 2 and so on. And two quarterbacks that are going to be like stars in college football. See if I can say this. Jaron Kiave Sangapolatele from California and Micah Alajedo, the two quarterbacks. So there you go.
Oh, right. Yeah. Isn't Cal's quarterback, isn't he like pretty highly touted? He was the guy that I think went to Oregon and then came back. Yeah. So, hey, something to watch there. And yeah, I think you have to be a true degenerate if you're wagering on that game. And if you are, hey, go take advantage of our friends over at MyBookie while you still can. Presenting sponsor of the show, MyBookie.ag, promo code SEC, free $500 wager free bet if you use the promo code SEC. And what that means is anything you put into the account up to 500, if you put in that promo code SEC, let's say you lose it immediately, which you will if you listen to Cousin Shane, not if you listen to Steven here. But if you lose it, they'll put it right back in your account, but only if you use that promo code SEC over at mybookie.ag. And while you're at it, to get over the holiday, maybe you hate your family. I know some of us do. I have got some cousins that you guys know that I don't care for. But the way I get through Cousin Shane's jammer is Tennessee Legend Distillery helps me actually hang out with that crazy man. So shout out Tennessee Legend, official spirit of that SEC podcast. Stephen, before we get into the action, let us know, what is your maybe your favorite at the old Lassen household, favorite Christmas time tradition? Anything stand out to you?
That's a good question because, you know, once you have like a one-year-old, everything starts to change. So like, are your traditions with your parents and your other family start to change? You know, unfortunately, you know, we used to go to my grandparents' house, you know, unfortunately, like both of them passed away. But I think, you know, I try to take like Christmas Eve and Christmas to spend as much time with the family as possible. We do a little gift exchange on Christmas Eve and some on Christmas. So kind of boring traditions, I guess, but that's kind of like the Lassen household. We get together, we eat, and we unwrap gifts, and we watch football. So,
well, I would imagine, Stephen, having your own kids, the beauty of that, you get to start your own new tradition. So maybe this is the year. I'll challenge you to start a Lassen family tradition. How about that?
I like where you're thinking because the one-year-old doesn't know it, but she's got something good coming on Christmas Day. She's going to be like zipping around this neighborhood like crazy. So
Santa was looking out for her, it sounds like.
Yes. Santa was definitely looking out for her this year. She was good. So she gets a good gift. She has sat through many a football game. She's already learning. She points out the word ball when she sees the ball in the air. So she's doing very well. We are training her to, be the next generation of that SEC podcast fans.
Absolutely. Well, Stephen, you know who got a really good gift this Christmas was Alabama fans. Come on, went on going on the road, became the first team ever to win on the road in the college football playoff history by beating the Sooners 34-24. What a game this was. Sooners jumped out to a 17-0 lead. And oh, I know I fired off some tweets. I think most of us did. A lot of people deleted them. Shout out Nicole Era back here. Bama couldn't even get a first down in the first three possessions. It looked like they were over and done with. But, of course, they came roaring back and beat the Sooners. Man, what a game this was. What was your thoughts on it, Stephen?
Mike, I have to admit, when it was 17-0, it looked pretty bleak for Alabama, right? And yeah. I was not confident at all that they were going to come back in this game. But credit to Alabama. And I think the funny thing about this game was football is very simple, but it's also very complicated. And it's also very weird because if you match the two games up, you know, the first time it's like Alabama dominated the stat sheet, but they lost the moments and they lost the game. This time around, Oklahoma outgained them 362 to 260, but they lost the moments. And so it's funny how the bounces went Oklahoma's way the first time, but they didn't go that way the second time. And of course, I think you could run through like several plays, Mike. I mean, the third down play that, you know, it's been talked about a lot where Mateer makes some sort of weird throw, running back doesn't catch it, big missed opportunity. Ty Simpson's play in the first half, kind of towards the end, getting the ball to Brooks. I mean, certainly we can talk about like people stepping up, like Lo Brooks stepping up with the game being, you know, 17-0 and helping Alabama come back. Like Simpson getting back on track in that stretch, big time play. Then also credit to Alabama's defense, Mike. I mean, I thought, you know, for we can talk about how much the offense has sputtered. I think the defense for Alabama has more than held its own in the second half and for the most part, the bulk of the season. So I think it was critical that Alabama finally got something going on offense. They got a big run, of course, by Daniel Hill. Simpson was hitting some nice throws. And then Alabama's defense kind of closing the deal. 5 sacks, 7 tackles for a loss, pick six. You knew it wasn't Oklahoma's night when Tate Sandell's missing field goals, right? Like that's, it's just that those kind of things, the moments went Oklahoma's way the first time, they went Alabama's way the second time. Really big time credit to Alabama for coming back in a very difficult spot.
What stands out to you more though, Steven, Alabama's resolve, being able to come back from a huge deficit, 17 points on the road, or the collapse from the Sooners? Obviously same situation, up 17 at home, stadium rocking. Which one is, do you, you know, is more you know, surprising to you, I guess?
Man, that's a good question. They're kind like I could almost talk myself into both, but I think probably Alabama's comeback, like resolve, because I think when they were down 17-0, Mike, it really felt like, oh, this is just a continuation of what we saw at the end of the season. We saw this team kind of sputtering. There were plenty of people, not me, who didn't think they should be in the playoff. I thought they had earned their way into it. And, you know, losing to Georgia, arguably, potentially the best team in the field by the end of the season, maybe, you know, they earned their way into the playoff by playing those tough games, like showing this kind of clutch gene during the season. They, every time there was a South Carolina, but there was clutch plays against Missouri, they made them. So they earned their way into the field, Mike. But I think what was concerning was kind of the offense had just been kind of sputtering, no running game. And it kind of felt like, hey, you're down 17. Oklahoma can just tee off at this point. That, you know, if you, it's going to be really hard to get back into this. So I think Alabama getting back into it when as bleak as it looked is probably more surprising to me.
Yeah. And I hope this is accurate. I heard this statistic earlier today, actually right before we hopped on, that the, I believe it was Daniel Hill for Bama who had like a 30 something yard run. I heard that was the longest run Bama had had since week two. Against ULM. Wow. I didn't look that up. I probably should before I just have this, but I heard it on, I think it was Oklahoma Breakdown podcast. They do a really good job. So I don't think they're just making stuff up, but if that's accurate, I mean, that's pretty wild considering how elite Oklahoma's defense is that they, and again, it wasn't like they gave up a 90 yard run. It was like a 30 yard run. But that kind of paints the picture of how one-dimensional Alabama is.
It's funny that they got that 30-yard rush because, like you said, of how dominant Oklahoma has been this year against the run and the way they can get to the quarterback. And, oh, by the way, R. Mason Thomas was back. So a defense that was already very good in the first meeting was even better the second time by having it full strength. I mean, you're right, Mike. They had two rushes of 30-plus yards this season and one of 40-plus. The only team that had fewer in the SEC, Florida. They had one rush of 30 plus yards. So Mike, it's like timely things. Like Alabama didn't have a consistent rushing attack to get to 200 yards against Oklahoma, but that big running play couple other ones sprinkled in there. It was just enough. I mean, they were outgained on the scoreboard, but like I said, they won those moments. You throw in the pick six, the special teams mistakes. Against a team like Oklahoma, where the defense was so good, it's like we talked about it leading up to the game. The small things, the moments were going to win it, and that's what it did for Alabama.
Hmm. And now let's switch gears to Oklahoma real quick. There's going to be a lot that needs to be retooled in the offseason. But if there's just one or two things maybe that really stand out that you believe Oklahoma's got to accomplish to take that next step, where would you go with that?
Mike, I think the first thing is I thought that John Mateer looked healthier on Friday night. I thought, you know, velocity, like confidence wise, it seemed to be higher than it was at the end of the season. Hard to put kind of like a stat on that. It's more just kind of like an eye test thing. So I think getting him to the next level, I think not only just in terms of health, but also play. It does feel like, and I think I was watching the Skycam version at the same time of the game, and it's like there were some throws I thought, okay, that's open, he's got to hit it. And I think that's kind of the next level. Is Arbuckle's doing a good job, I think, of like scheming the offense, building the offense. I think the next level is like, can Mateer take his game to that next level and kind of match that? So I think getting Mateer fully back on track, second year at Oklahoma, you can improve the supporting cast. Also would like to see growth on the offensive line. You know, you look at some of the younger pieces that they brought in, and I think this is maybe a check in Oklahoma's favor for next season too, is, you know, they have brought in transfers, but they're not like 40, 50 player transfer classes. Like, they're doing a good job of recruiting freshmen and developing them, and they did that with this team. So I think the next step is, like, can you get your offensive line up to another level too, to get your rushing attack going, to take some of that pressure off of Mateer? Because I think we know Brent Venables is going to build a pretty good defense, right? So if Oklahoma is going to get back next year, to me, it's all about the offense.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you said that, because I know it's easy for me to answer since I asked the question. But for me, Steven, I think it's all about that running game. There has to be some semblance of that. And that goes hand in hand with where you just ended that with the offensive line. You can't run the ball if you can't block. But I just looked it up. John Mateer leads the team in rushing attempts. we can't have that. 149 attempts rushing by John Mateer. Next closest is Torrey Blaylock, 120. So I think they're too pass heavy. And at times you can get away with that, but not in this conference. And not when you have an elite defense. You want to minimize how many snaps they're facing. The less snaps you can put on your defense, the more elite they're going to be. So it kind of works hand in hand. They got to get a ground game if they really want to compete for a national championship. Do you think that's fair?
I think that's 100% fair for a couple reasons. I mean, I think if you go back way back to, you know, September or October, when we were talking about Mateer and Oklahoma, especially like after they beat Michigan, I think we both kind of agreed that, hey, it was going to be tough for like Mateer to withstand like 20, you know, 15, 20 carries in the SEC. You know, I don't think you want him accumulating that. And I think if you take a step back and just like remove like Mateer and you just look at a quarterback stats over like freshman, sophomore, junior, senior, you always want to see rushing attempts probably going down and passing go up because it's like the natural progression. There is kind of like that gunslinger mentality that you don't want to take out of his game. But I think if you want to help him, like two things, like Mateer has to get better himself, but you also have to give him the setup to do so. And so you can't just be, hey, it's 3rd and 7. Let's get out there and create a play. No, if you're in 3rd and 3, it's going to help him a lot. So taking some pressure off of him by having a better run game, creating some more manageable situations and efficiency. I mean, they averaged about 3.5 yards per carry this year. I mean, I would like to see that total be closer, certainly over 4, closer to 4.5 next year. And then you're really talking about this offense going to the next level. So rushing attack, Mateer, growth on the offensive line. I feel like those three things can really help Oklahoma get back to the playoff next season.
And we will talk more about Alabama here in a minute to preview their matchup against Alabama. But I wanted to shout out this amazing Bammer, Steven Up.
Always showing up for them boys in Tuscaloosa. It's Steven Up. Roll Tide.
We love all Stevens on this channel. And Steven Up, you're up there with Steven Lassen. So shout out Steven Up. He gifted Amos Moses. Amos, welcome to
the family.
Yeah. Thank you, Steven. And thank you, Steven Up. And man, we're lucky tonight, Steven. Shout out Tim, gave us $100. Merry Christmas to that SEC podcast. Y'all are the best. Go Rebs and go SEC. 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 So let's talk. Maybe the hottest team in the SEC, Steven. They just wallop Tulane. Shout out Tam. We're doing this for you. Let's switch gears to Ole Miss, Steven. 41-10. Scored 14 points right off the bat. I believe it was seven plays. I had it written down here. Seven plays. I think 100. Let me just double check this real quick because I have it written down here. Yeah, excuse me. The first seven plays of the game, 145 yards, two touchdowns, jumped on Tulane, got a pick, first possession for Tulane. And, I mean, this was never really a contest. This is what we thought and we were hoping we were getting from the Ole Miss Rebels. So they march on to face Georgia in the Sugar Bowl. What was your thoughts, Steven, on Ole Miss winning big at home?
Lane who? Right. Mike, I think there was something fascinating to me about this, the way this game set up. And so if you'll indulge me for just a second, it felt like Pete Golding was the supporting character and not the main character on Saturday. And I felt like every time it was, you know, Pete, it's your first game and all that. It was players and fans. Did it feel that way, Mike? He was kind of going to that.
I would agree with that.
Yeah, it felt, like the players led the walk. It was after the game, he was talking about the players and he was talking about the fans. And, certainly I think we know what the former coach said about the fans sometimes this year. So I think Pete Golding really checked every box that he needed to in his debut. I mean, it was a perfect setup. You had a team that was a massive underdog that you had already beaten once this year. You had him at your place. All that focus on Lane Kiffin and all the drama, it was good to just put the ball in the tee, kick it off, and for 60 minutes, take care of business. And that's exactly what Ole Miss did. Love the fact that they came out red hot, scored, and put Tulane away. Sure, Tulane moved the ball at times, but Ole Miss got the stops they needed to. And I think with that high-powered offense, if Tulane couldn't keep this closer, lower possession game, there was really no chance. So I felt like Pete Golding passed all the tests that he needed to in his first game, Mike. Love the fact that they took care of business from the jump and then put this team away in the second half. I don't really think there's a ton that you can criticize Golding for. It really felt like a kind of an A-plus kind of debut. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, this is what everybody, in fairness, this is what everyone was expecting. Like, it would have been a massive, massive upset, surprise, whatever you want to call it, if Tulane actually won this game. So, yeah, he passed the test, but I think if you're not an Ole Miss fan, you're probably still in wait-and-see mode with him, and I think that's fair too. But let me ask you this, because I think one of the big storylines entering this game was just kind of, I wanted to see this team, how it was operated, how the offense in particular, how efficient they were without, of course, Lane Kiffin. Did you notice anything that like something was missing at all when you watch this game?
I don't think so. Mike, it's also, I think to your point, it was a game that they were projected to win and they did, and they've already played once this year. So I think the real kind of proof is going to be the Georgia game in the Sugar Bowl. And of course, too, I think in fairness to Pete Golding, I think you have to give him a chance to like put his stamp on the program. So like, this is just the continuation of 2025. The real proof will be in 2026 and beyond. Now, I think if they get blown out by Georgia, I think there's probably going to be a lot of people who go, oh, like that wasn't very good. Are we sure this is going to work out? But I think as far as, there's so much momentum right now behind Pete Golding because of what's happened. And so just being able to go out there and crush Tulane by 31 points and just check all the boxes, like defense only gave up 10 points. You didn't have like a bunch of errors. They didn't look overmatched or underprepared. Like for this game, they look good. Now, I think the bigger questions for me go to game two and beyond. But most importantly, they won and they moved on. And for 60 minutes, it was about Pete Golding, Trinidad Chambliss, and Kiwon Lacy. I will say, I assume we'll get Kiwon Lacy like back for the bowl game, like or for the Sugar Bowl. Like that is a concern for me, is like what's the status of like Lacy as they go to play against Georgia. But still a long time for that game kicks off.
Mm-hmm. And shout out our buddy Tolkien. He's always back with donations. Steven, one team has to go, and Ole Miss ain't leaving. So we'll preview that game here in just a minute. But we got to do it, Steven. We got to rip the Band-Aid off. And that's basically what it was watching this damn game. Shout out Miami. Credit to them. Dominating the line of scrimmage. Beating A&M 10-3 in Kyle Field. What a letdown this was, Steven. And yeah, never in a million years, if you would have guaranteed me that Miami only scored 10 points in this game, I would have said, well, I guess they're getting hammered because yeah. A&M's getting more than 10, but didn't happen, did it?
Mike, I if you would have showed me the box score and said Miami scored 10 points, Carson Beck threw for 103 yards, I would have said, oh, yeah, Texas A&M won, right? And it's probably by like 10 points. But I know a lot of people were saying, especially on social media during this game is terrible, like making all these jokes. I actually thought that this game was intense and there was a ton of tension because it felt like one or two plays is going to decide this thing. So maybe I'm the outlier, but I also thought like, you think about the tension, you think about like the one play could decide this game, but also it was like big boy football for 60 minutes. You had the crowd, great atmosphere at Kyle Field. This is exactly what the playoff should be. Miami and A&M first round. Like it was two heavyweights trading punches for 60 minutes. And sure, there were some errors on special teams and missed field goals. And, you know, we'll get into some of the other things, but high stakes, a game of 60 minutes of tension, I was all in on it. So I know some people may not have enjoyed it, but I did. And Mike, much like we talked about with A&M and Oklahoma, the small things caught up to Texas A&M in this game. Do you think that's fair?
Yeah, no doubt. And once again, you know, this Oklahoma, just like you said, this one, we always overlook special teams. They were a disaster for the playoff losers out of the SEC this weekend. So, you know, that first missed field goal on the block, that was awful. That's when it really set in for me. It was like, uh-oh, this ain't going to be our day, is it? You know, I mean, you can't be getting chip shot field goals blocked. I mean, good Lord, that was bad. So Miami had the big punt return, right? I think they had two returns that were pretty good. It was just and particularly I think it's even worse, Stephen, with Texas A&M being the one that was talking trash. Yeah, which I love trash talk. Give me all the trash talk you want, but you got to back it up. And Miami, I didn't see much trash talk from them before. I saw a hell of a lot at the end, but hey, they deserve it because they went out there and they whooped their ass. Even Coach Elko said it, you know, we got dominated on the line of scrimmage. And it's eerily reminiscent, Stephen, of last season when they got dominated by Texas. And, you know, Coach Elko said, you know, we're going to get better from this. And here we are again. You know, it's disappointing end of the season.
Mike, I will tell you what my first sign of concern for Texas A&M was. It was actually in the first half when Miami was actually running the ball pretty well. And if you just looked kind of like follow this Miami team, like from a big play standpoint, they haven't been a big play offense this year, but they've been more about efficiency. And especially in the run game, like they took a step back from last year. They had Damian Martinez, who was a 1,000-yard rusher last year. Got a good collection, but you know, like the stat sheet, like they were like seventh in the ACC in rushing, good, but not great. And there were a couple times where, you know, there was a run and it was like, uh-oh, if they just stick to this, they might pop a big run in the second half. And sure enough, of course, there was the big run by Mark Fletcher. So I thought early on, those kind of off and on concerns we've had about Texas A&M's rushing attack, I think those showed up. but also it was, there was the fumble in the first like half, and it felt like, okay, you've got that, you got the block field goal, they're running the ball well. Carson Beck didn't play all that well, but he also didn't turn the ball over. So in a game where it was super tight, you're looking at things like those missed field goals, like the turnover, the interception in the end zone, and Texas A&M getting dominated at the line of scrimmage. That was also pretty surprising to me, considering how well this team has played this year. And full credit, Miami's front is very good. Reuben Bain and Mizador and some of those other guys, they've got a couple waves of guys who can create problems. But for a team that's got a good set of, on the trenches, they got overpowered there on Saturday. So you add that, field goals, turnovers, iffy quarterback play, I think all those things added up to a Texas A&M loss.
Hey, let me ask you, Stephen, same thing I asked Cousin Shane last night. I'm just kind of curious where you'll go with this. But the two teams that got defeated in the playoff out of the SEC, Oklahoma, of course, and Texas A&M, which team... And a lot can change, so we won't hold this your opinion against you. Nobody clip this. It's December 22nd. But if you had to pick one, Stephen, Oklahoma, A&M, which team more likely to make a return to the playoff next season, where would you go with that?
I would probably take Oklahoma right now. I think Texas A&M is still very much a very viable contender for the playoff. A couple things, Mike. I mean, I think we know they're going to have some turnover line of scrimmage. I also think from a offensive standpoint, I need to see Marcel Reed take a step forward and need to see how the Wiggins-Reed pairing works out overall. In a big picture too, this is now two seasons. I know this narrative is going to come up. I'm not that worried about it, but it's now two seasons where the play kind of tailed off as the season went along. I think you can kind of explain both of that with the game against Texas and a playoff game. But if you want to make that next step to be a team that wins the SEC, wins playoff games, all of these small concerns that we've talked about, getting Marcel Reed to the next level, fixing some of these things on the defense, all of those things have to add up next year if A&M wants to exceed this just trip to the playoff and actually win some games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, is it fair? And again, this has really got nothing to do with next season, but is it fair if you're an Oklahoma fan? I think you're sitting here today and saying, man, we gave that one away. We should have won. Whereas if you're an A&M fan, I think if you're honest with yourself, you'd be like, God, we never really had a shot to – I mean, they had their shots, but at no point were you watching that game being like, oh, we're about to beat this team. You know, it was like you were saying, it was like intensity. It was like they were puckered up for that game.
Yeah. It felt like that one was way more of a toss up, you know, and it felt like with the mistakes adding up, it did feel like kind of Miami was, I mean, obviously it was 0-0 and then 3-0. They were kind of in control of the game a little bit. Whereas Oklahoma being up 17-0, I think it was pretty clear that they were in control of that one. I think, you know, just thinking ahead a little bit too, you know, this is going to be an interesting debate between Oklahoma and Texas A&M, because I think we start thinking about like the quarterback kind of carousel in the SEC next year. You know, a lot of spots are going to be open. Like what happens at LSU, what's going to happen with Tennessee, what's going to happen. I mean, we know Arch is coming back to Texas A&M. We'll see what happens with Ole Miss, Alabama. It's a lot of questions around the league, but I think both teams like Oklahoma and Texas A&M, you got two starters who've been pretty good, but they're going to have to be better for these teams to go even further next year. Do you think that's fair?
Oh yeah, no, without a doubt. And it's, I mean, it could go either way. You could convince me, you know, it could be either one or both of them could take a huge step forward. Could be difficult for either one to be much better. I don't know. It could go either way.
I also have a lot more confidence right now in Ben Arbuckle than I do first time play caller at A&M. And Wiggins may be fine. I just think we've seen a little bit of a track record out of Arbuckle, whether it's at Washington State and Oklahoma. And granted, there's still a long way to go offensively for Oklahoma, but you could easily start to kind of see you upgrade some receivers around the tier. The offensive line settles in another year in this scheme. I think A&M's going to probably have to replace at least two, maybe three offensive line starters you know, Mario Craver's back, but still trying to get some more weapons. You know, there's definitely some questions here. I think they'll be very good once again, but I think getting back to the playoff is going to require some answers in the portal and talent development in the program.
All right, Steven. So let's take a look ahead to the quarterfinals. What's your thoughts on Alabama, Indiana? Indiana, I believe, is a 7-point favorite, unless that has changed. What's your initial thoughts on this matchup, Alabama, Indiana, in the Rose Bowl?
Just like we all predicted, right? Number one, Indiana with the Heisman Trophy winner is a favorite over Alabama in the Rose Bowl, right? Just like everybody predicted. Also, Mike, a little kind of little bit of a weird twist. You know, both Kalen DeBoer was an assistant at Indiana. Kurt Cignetti was an assistant at Alabama. So some ties between the two programs already. I think what's interesting in the big picture is you saw those teams that had the bye week last year. Now, the seeding was screwed up because, you know, Boise and Arizona State weren't in the top four. They got byes. Well, they lost. We saw Oregon come out very rusty against Ohio State. They lost. So first round byes, not great last year. And Georgia lost, of course, but, you know, not having given first time starting quarterback, we'll put a little asterisk by that one. So teams with a bye week were 0-4. Indiana coming off the Big Ten championship win, super high. You know, now they've had all this time to get ready. I'm curious to see, does the rust factor in here too? But I think if you zoom out a little bit, Mike, Fernando Mendoza is going to get all the credit, and rightfully so. They are very good at receiver, though. And also, the biggest reason Indiana went from being, hey, we're just here in the playoff this year, to number one seed, is they've gotten a lot better on the offensive and defensive lines. And that's one of the biggest reasons they were able to beat Ohio State a few weeks ago.
Where are they getting all these linemen? Are they mostly portal?
Some portal guys, some guys they had in the program that they were able to develop. I will note one important injury. Stephen Daly was one of their top pass rushers. He's out. He got hurt, I think, actually in the post game against Ohio State in the Big Ten championship game. So he's out. They're going to have to shuffle some guys. If you want to kind of wonder how that might mean for the matchup, watching Indiana this season, they do a great job. Bryant Haynes, their defensive coordinator, one of the rising stars, they do a good job getting pressure and creating some pressure, and they do a lot of things schematically. They did that to Ohio State, and they shut down their run game. And Ohio State's run game has been kind of shaky this year, but I'm sitting there going to Alabama going, they haven't run the ball just that well this year. Can they create some pressure too? Because one of the reasons they were able to win that game was, hey, they can stop. They stopped the run for Ohio State, and they could devote more attention to those receivers. So that matchup of Ohio State really prepared Indiana for what's about to come with Alabama on January 1.
Shout out Stephen Up. He said, I think a healthy Bama defense will give Indiana trouble. What's your thoughts on that matchup? How does Kane Womack match up with the Indiana defense or offense? Excuse me.
I think so too. Spot on. So first of all, I think if there is a weakness on this Indiana team, it's the offensive line. They've had some injuries there. They got healthy late in the season. You know, you think back to the Penn State game. One of the reasons why they had to have that incredible catch is their offensive line struggled. They gave up 3 sacks to Ohio State. Not totally surprising. Ohio State's got a good defensive front. But yes, I think like the speed, the athleticism that Alabama has. I mean, you think about the fronts that Indiana's faced this year, like Oregon, Ohio State, like Iowa. They faced some good ones, but those teams all gave Indiana some trouble. So I think especially if LT Overton can go, I know there's like some optimism it sounded like today from Kalen DeBoer that he might have a chance to be available. Just coming off that performance where they wreaked havoc against Oklahoma's offensive line in the second half, and maybe you get some guys healthy, I think this Alabama front is going to create some havoc in the Rose Bowl on January 1 for sure.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting, Stephen. And also, you mentioned how unique this matchup is in many regards. I think perhaps the most interesting is the fact that, I mean, never in a million years, of course, college football changes quicker than ever now, but never in a million years would I imagine that Alabama will have the ability to play the undercard role, the underdog to mighty Indiana in a Rose Bowl playoff game showdown. Alabama plays pretty well, Stephen, as a doubted team. It's so rare that it's happened. Do you know the last time Alabama was this large of a underdog?
Man, it has to have been a while, right?
Oh, it's been a while. I've quizzed the last two people I've on this show. Neither one of them's gotten it. So
It's not that Georgia game with Alabama, right? When like Nick Saban's like,
well, Marler says that's the one, but I think he's incorrect, because I think that one was 5.5, 6 in favor of Georgia, but this is 7. So you have to go back even further. The last time Alabama was underdog by 7 or more.
Hmm. So it's like pre Nick Saban?
Well, I didn't say that.
Okay. Yeah. Oh man. I don't know. I'm kind of stumped on this one.
You have to go all the way back to the SEC championship against Urban Meyer. I think it's 2008. It may have been 2009, because then they go back to back. But
yeah,
either way, I think it was the second one with Tebow crying and all that. I think Florida was like an 8-point favorite.
I think that's right. I do remember that now. Yeah, that definitely makes total sense now that we jump into that one. I think the underdog role. You know, you think back after the game against Oklahoma, where, you know, Ty Simpson was like thanking everybody for picking against Alabama. It's kind of a weird spot for this team to be in, because they're always just the favorite. But also, I think that works in their favor. And I think that's kind of the, you know, we kind of joked about it a few minutes ago, but Indiana's number one. All the pressure's on them. A lot of people picked against Alabama in the first round. They're going to pick against them here. Everybody's going to pick Indiana. I mean, Heisman Trophy winners had a kind of a track record there of not playing well in the bowl games. And you kind of look at the matchups on the offensive lines and see, or line of scrimmage and see, okay, hey, if Alabama can hold its own here, if they can protect Ty Simpson, I like the Alabama receivers and the depth that they have, especially with Brooks coming off that game. You give Quavis time to get healthy. I mean, if I'm Alabama, I know 7-point underdog, but there's some matchups here I think they can take advantage of.
Right. And hey, I call them big game to boring, but that guy coaches his ass off in these big games. So I like to give him a hard time, but again, I know Cignetti, he gets all this credit. That's fantastic. I think DeBoer has coached more big games this year than probably Cignetti has his entire career. And DeBoer did it last year too, and even at Washington. And I think I was more impressed. I can't imagine Washington was spending the money that Indiana's spending these days. So I think it was even a better coaching job then to get Washington all the way to the national championship in a 4-team playoff. Cignetti ain't done that. So, but I think there's a chance, Stephen, that Alabama's got the coaching edge in this matchup too.
Well, also, if you think about how Alabama's kind of had its back against the wall for most of the season too, like after losing to Florida State, then you get into the grind of the SEC schedule and you got to play, you know, at Missouri, you got to play Tennessee. You've got to go like after heavyweight, you know, like Michigan State, UCLA, Maryland, Wisconsin, Purdue, like those all teams all popped up on Indiana's schedule. they've had tough games, like with Iowa, Oregon, of course, the Penn State game. Penn State's not as good as most people thought. They had Ohio State. Like, they've answered the bell. But I think if you just had to go like pound for pound, week to week, Alabama's been clutch in some very high leverage spots. And I think about that for January 1, thinking if this game is close, you know, Indiana came through against Ohio State. They came through against Oregon and Iowa. But Alabama is battle tested. Like, whether they're down 17-0, if it's 13-10 in the fourth quarter, it's kind of one of those, like you said, with DeBoer's ability to pull out the big games, their clutchness this season. It's almost like if you're an Alabama fan, hey, you're not sweating it. If we're down 20-17 the fourth quarter, this team has just showed they've got like 9 lives and just keep finding ways to come back and win these games.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's switch gears to New Orleans, Stephen, where we got Ole Miss, Georgia, part 2, another rematch. I wonder, Ole Miss, they haven't played a Miami or Ohio State, but it'd be funny if they did, because then they could have three rematches in a row in a college football playoff. But thoughts on this matchup? Georgia, a 7-point favorite last time I checked. SEC champs, both these teams, what, only lost one game this year. They played in Athens earlier this year, 43-35. Georgia won it, but Ole Miss had a 9-point lead in the fourth quarter, so the separation between these two is quite minimal, to be honest with you.
Absolutely. I think the first thing that jumps out to me, Mike, is I hope we get another thriller like we did the first time. 800 total yards, 78 points scored in that first matchup. I'm going to guess it's probably not as high scoring this time around, but it does feel like it's going to probably come down again to the fourth quarter. And you think about that first matchup, both these teams now have had that first matchup. They have a pretty good feel of both teams. And now we've had, you know, games after that. And it does feel like we know exactly what Ole Miss is and we know what exactly what Georgia is. And Georgia has been trending up over the second half of the season, especially on defense. You know, they've allowed only 29 points in their last four games. You know, they've cleaned up some of the big plays. They've been doing a better job at the pass rush. So I just think about how that first game played out. I see what Georgia's done on defense and think this is probably going to be a little bit tougher for the Ole Miss offense this time around to put up 30 plus points. But it also feels like, given that firepower, given the motivation for Ole Miss, it feels like once again, this game could be very even into the fourth quarter, much like we saw the last time. And those last two or three possessions end up deciding this one. So I'm pretty fired up for another rematch because that first game was pretty awesome.
Yeah, and much like Indiana, Alabama, not the same situation, obviously, but similar, where Ole Miss could be the underdog. They're going to be doubted. They're going to be playing with house money. This is mighty Georgia. This is the program in the Southeastern Conference right now. And, you know, you've got motivation that you believe you could play with this team. You got motivation to prove that Lane Kiffin was not the program. And, again, which I think it's fair to say, you know, it's a big ask, but if Ole Miss were to pull this off, all those people still questioning, you know, how good of a head coach is Pete Golding? I mean, yeah, he's not going to be defined by one game, but I think it'll go a long way to people believing in Pete Golding and the future of this program. And I think it'll do a lot for Charlie Weiss, obviously, and more importantly, these players that, you know, this is legitimately this is a national championship contender that I think very few people are, for whatever reason, view it as that after losing Kiffin.
Mike, I think if Ole Miss wins this game, you want to talk about the confidence factor and belief in Pete Golding is going to skyrocket. Because I think Georgia could be the best team in the field, and I think they could end up winning the national title if they win this game. So I think if you're Ole Miss and you go, look, we've played these guys once, they're the favorite. You know, all the pressure's on them. Nobody believes that Ole Miss is going to get there because Lane Kiffin's gone. So all the motivation should be for Ole Miss to prove people wrong. But also, if you go win this game, if you beat Georgia, you can beat anybody the rest of the way, because I think that, like I said, I think that Georgia could easily win the national title this year. So if Ole Miss beats Georgia, they can beat Ohio State or Miami. They could beat Indiana, Texas Tech, or Oregon down the road. There are some things I think, you know, we saw that first matchup, Trinidad Chambliss completed 53% of his passes. Basically, that was the lowest completion rate that he's had in a game as a starter this year. So, you know, it's like those kind of things, if they can clean up some of those things, you know, and you talk about if all the motivation on Ole Miss, all the pressure for Georgia, if Ole Miss goes out and wins this game, I mean, any kind of doubters about Pete Golding, they're erased by, like, you know, 11 o'clock on January 1st if Ole Miss is hoisting that Sugar Bowl trophy.
How big of a task is it for Ole Miss, though, to compete with Georgia on the line of scrimmage? Because I think that'll be the toughest test for Ole Miss in this game.
I think so. I think Georgia's rushing attack against the Ole Miss rush defense, that's like the matchup I think that's probably going to end up deciding this game. Because I think in theory, I think the way this could play out is like Georgia tries to keep Kevon Lacy in check, gets Chambliss like in third and long. If you're Ole Miss, can you do the same thing? Can you keep Nate Frazier, Chauncey Bowens, the Georgia backfield in check, make Gunnar Stockton beat you on third and long, and keep both quarterbacks like in check too from a rushing perspective? Also, I think we kind of saw this in the first meeting too. I think red zone defense is going to be really important too, because I think you're okay. Like, you're Georgia, you know, this offense just has so much firepower and so much talent. They're probably going to hit a big play or two, but if you bend a little bit, but don't break, and you give up a field goal, but you have like a 10 play drive that just eats up a lot of time and you're wearing down the defense and you get a touchdown and you start trading threes and sevens, you feel pretty good whichever side you are. So I think, can Ole Miss stop the Georgia rushing attack? And then two, I think who wins those red zones and third down stops is probably going to end up winning this game.
And then one thing, I don't know how much of a factor this really will be, but it's on my mind, Stephen. We're in this new era, right, where everybody's a free agent, and we don't even know if Trinidad, if he's going to be getting another year of eligibility. But let's say he does, or let's just say he goes to the NFL. I don't know, whatever. But let's say he comes back. If he dominates Georgia again, now he cooled in the fourth quarter. I think he was like 1 for 10. And that's why Ole Miss lost. But before that, he was razor sharp. He was the difference. He was the reason why Ole Miss was whooping Georgia for three quarters. Let's say he does something like that again, but he finishes the deal this time. I mean, his price tag will go through the roof. And again, I think that's something to consider in these matchups where, I mean, I can't imagine there's going to be a guy more locked in than Trinidad. And again, if he has an epic performance, he might make $5 million next year wherever he's playing college football. Do you think that could be a factor?
I think 100% for him. I think you could also say that too for probably a lot of these guys on the Ole Miss roster, just given the coaching change and not knowing what's going to happen. I mean, the portal opens the next day, January 2nd. And you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, Mike. It feels like, was Golding the coach that was talking about like value after the win Saturday? You know, creating value, like whether it was the coaches, whether it was the players, and you're thinking, everything in college football is like 1 year transaction right now. And so if Chambliss balls out, if some of these receivers, if it's somebody on defense, whether it's the price tag for Ole Miss can go up in a matter of a game, the price tag for somebody else could go up a lot in the course of that game too. So the playoff is going to allow some of these guys to make a lot of money. So there's motivation to show up and deliver when you're called upon, so that way you can cash a few extra NIL dollars the next year.
Right. And I love the fact that Pete Golding put that out there. He said for every player, for every coach, the value is on the table. Even players that, you know, that are not starters. Let's say something unfortunate happened. Let's say Kevon Lacy can't play, which I hope doesn't happen. And then the backup, I know it, well, this is probably a bad example because their backup, I think, is a fifth-year running back. But let's say it wasn't a fifth-year running back, and he comes in here and he scores two or three touchdowns. All of a sudden, he's getting calls in the portal. And he even said that, whether it's here or elsewhere, perform in these situations, your price is going to go up. And I just think there's a lot of value in that, Stephen, as opposed to Dabo Swinney, you know, who's, you know, doesn't want to use the portal. It's not, it's culture. That's fantastic. And that's probably, if we're being 100% truthful, it's probably college football as a sport, as a development, as all these things. It probably is better the way Dabo wants it. And I'm not a Dabo fan, but that ain't the way it is. Right. you can have Dabo on an island. We ain't doing the portal. And then you got all these other savages that literally quit on their playoff team, and there's players that quit in the middle of the year, and I mean, this is the chaotic system we have. I want a head coach that is 1,000% going down that route, because that's the only way we're going to keep winning, is if we utilize the tools to our especially when we're at a place like Ole Miss. I'm not trying to be disrespectful, but historically not the elite, but if we're being honest, Steven, they have been elite in this NIL era, this portal era, because they're utilizing it to its fullest extent, arguably more than anyone.
Mike, I would agree with you on the Dabo thing. Like, I think college football is probably better when you actually have some development in a program over a couple of years. But also, I think, just look at what's happened to Clemson the last couple of years. Like, it's eroding away, the 7-5 finish this year. So I think, regardless of whatever you think of the rules are the rules, and you take advantage of them. And Ole Miss has done, I mean, like you said, they have been one of the leaders at the forefront of all the NIL and transfer portal developments, because that, you know, hey, it's to your advantage. Like, if you want to play by the rules and, you know, all the cap and not, you know, with all the uncertainty surrounding the CSC and the rules and whatever's going to happen with that, some teams are being cautious, some teams are pushing the envelope. The teams that are pushing the envelope are the ones that are going to do the best. And so regardless of whether you like the rules or not, that's the field. And if you don't play there, everybody else is. So that's why I credit Ole Miss a lot for saying, hey, there's a lane. If we take it, we can go to the playoff. I guess lane's a bad pun. No pun intended on that one. the whole conversation about like NIL dollars and stuff, it reminded me, what's the saying? Like, yesterday's price is not today's price. It's like, you know, if you're Chambliss and you go out there and you ball out, you beat Georgia, like you said, your price tag goes from, oh, it's $3 million to now $5 million. So there's opportunity there for this Ole Miss team with the motivation and also what lies ahead, the unknown, but also the known of, hey, if we play well here, whether it's here or someone else, you know, these dollars are going to start adding up because of the opportunities that we created today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I see it in the comments, Stephen. Oh, this guy's going to LSU. It's already committed. And I get it. I mean, I've heard all that same stuff too, but this is a dirty game. And you're telling me I'm completely making these figures up, but let's say LSU told Kewan Lacy, we're gonna pay you $1.5 million. You know, if they go on a run here, and some crazy Ole Miss booster says, "Well, we're gonna give you $3 million," you think his ass going to LSU for half the price? I hate to tell you, he ain't. So, you know, crazy things could happen. Nothing set in stone, and the portal's not even open for several more weeks. So, that's where that's at, in my opinion.
Leverage. Everything is about leverage until someone is actually arriving on campus and they've signed that transferred documentation to go there. Mike also would just say Austin Simmons looked pretty good too, didn't he, against Tulane? I know it was just 5 passes. Trinidad Chambliss creates a bunch of value. You know, I think Ole Miss has got a pretty good quarterback, and if Chambliss decides to leave, if that's the case, I think Austin Simmons could be a pretty good quarterback next year still. So there's a lot at stake here for Ole Miss on January 1.
Right, and I'm glad you said that, Stephen, because I think Austin Simmons was as good as gone if Kiffin was back. And if Trinidad, whether he gets denied his waiver, which I think is a possibility as well, I think with Pete Golding, I think the relationship with Austin Simmons can be salvaged, and he may very well be their quarterback next year.
Yeah, I think so too, Mike. I'm going to be very interested to see about the dominoes that fall. Because like Sam Leavitt of Arizona State's kind of probably I'd say DJ Lagwe, Leavitt, you got Raiola, you've got a lot of big names out there, but you start to look at the suitors. It's like Miami, it's Oregon, it's Texas Tech. I think Texas Tech's going to end up with Brendan Sorsby, but once those top suitors start to fall off the board and the names go off, does a Chambliss go to LSU if he gets his waiver? And either way, if you're Pete Golding and you can salvage some sort of relationship with Austin Simmons, and you know you got John David Baker coming in, who at East Carolina they chuck the ball downfield a lot, I think that's a pretty good fit for Austin Simmons. So there's Ole Miss is in a very good spot whatever happens in the Sugar Bowl, because they got two quarterbacks they can win with next year regardless of how the portal plays out. And if they can salvage it with Simmons or they can keep Chambliss, they're in a good spot.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Stephen, what is your thoughts? I wanted to, speaking of all this transition and all this, that, and the other, but Texas making a big time move. Your favorite quarterback, Arch Manning, is going to be game planning now against Will Muschamp. How about that, buddy? What's your thoughts on Sarkisian switching gears, going from what on paper is an elite defensive coordinator? They're trying to upgrade with Will Muschamp. What's your thoughts on that move?
Mike, I will tell you, when I saw that news, the first thing I saw was, you know, Kwiatkowski was fired. And I was like, well, that's weird. And then I looked a second later and there was the Will Muschamp thing. And I was like, that is really weird, right? I mean, it's like two, like, you know, footballs hitting you in the face at the same time in terms of a move. I was really surprised. I mean, I mean, Texas defensively did have some issues this year, but in the big picture, like, the defense has not been a problem the last couple of years under Sark. I mean, they made the college football playoff twice. And so it was, I guess it's a move to go to try to get just to another level. And it feels like it's a very aggressive move, but you're hoping that Muschamp's aggressiveness pays off. And I think there were two things kind of that were mentioned. There were kind of like the ties to Georgia. Kind of seems like Sark is trying to chase Georgia a bit here, obviously, with the losses the last couple of years, trying to get to Georgia's level because they are that program. So maybe you take a branch off of that, try to bring them in, figure out what they're doing, try to gather some intel while also being maybe a little bit more, I guess, SEC friendly on defense. The other thing that was really interesting was Sark basically saying, I don't have to like babysit the headset on defense, right? That was just kind of like odd to me, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean,
well, and again, if he's taken, I did hear that as well, Steven. He's like, oh, he's been a head coach here and here. How did it go here and here? You know, yeah. it didn't go well. And again, where they really need help is on offense. And you just brought in a guy with the worst offensive track record in modern SEC that's had two jobs in this conference. I know Muschamp's not going to have anything to do with the offense, but
you hope not, right?
if he's in the building, it's I'm telling you, it's going to take a dip. You know what? So yeah. That would concern me.
Yeah, I can understand this. Like, if I guess it's the whole thing about like what Sark's like a trust factor with Kwiatkowski versus Muschamp. It's hard to know without like being there on game days. And maybe there are some things that Sark thinks like, if I give Will Muschamp just the ability to be the head coach of the defense, I trust him more. I trust him in game to handle things more than Kwiatkowski. Then I think it makes sense. He's also not exactly, I mean, he's been a defensive coordinator and he's been a pretty good one at times, but you know, he's been away from a few years. You know, it's an interesting move because I would not have guessed that the changes would come on defense this offseason. I would have guessed that there would have been some offensive changes given how the offensive line performed. Now, they did make a change at running back coach. That's a pretty small one, I think, given what's happened this year.
Right. And again, but by the numbers, the coaching grade, Muschamp, I'm not saying he's bad. I've never said that. But I have seen, and like I have a lot of respect for Brooks Austin. He said top five defensive coordinator in the country. There's literally no metric that supports that. So again, by the coaching grades, they need him to be essentially where they're already at defense. They need him to be the best defensive coordinator in the country to have an upgrade. So I don't know. Again, this is a major gamble. They're going to have all the talent in the world, though, so talent's not going to be an issue, and that's more important than the coaching anyway. But when you're trying to reach the heights of championships, you need them both, obviously. And this is a gamble, and I hope it pays off for them. But I don't know. It seems questionable at best.
Do we think Muschamp's last play calling experience was like when he was the head coach at South Carolina at some point in there on defense, maybe? And because he was an assistant at Georgia and he was a co-defensive coordinator, but obviously he wasn't the main play caller. I don't know if I don't think he's necessarily forgot anything about defense, but it's like you add that with the fact that he kind of stepped away from the on-field thing, the fact that the defense wasn't necessarily the problem. It's very bold. And if it works out, Sark looks like a genius. It also just, I don't, it's also, it's just puzzling, and there's not, it doesn't seem like it solves the main concern for me, which is you do wonder, like, hey, does Sark just have too much on his plate as play caller and head coach? I think it's hard to be both right now. I mean, you saw Ryan Day at Ohio State. He tried to hand off some play calling this year. And last year it worked out great with Chip Kelly. Didn't work out necessarily probably like he wants. He took it back for the rest of the playoffs. So, I mean, I think there is so much on coaches that you do wonder a little bit, like, could Sark use a little bit of help as a play caller? Do you think that's fair?
Oh, I think that 3 years in a row, Steven, they have regressed on offensive scoring efficiency with all the talent in the world. So, again, I guess they'll blame the offensive line. You know, I believe this was a hand-picked offensive line with an offensive line coach Sarkisian picked. So, I don't think they went into the year thinking the offensive line was going to be an issue, but that's on them to evaluate and develop.
I mean, is the play here Sark is more available to spend time with the offense now? Because I guess he's not having to, like, you know, watch over the defense as close. Do you think that solves anything? Because I don't.
No, I really don't. And another one, again, I can't say anything without pissing these people off, Steven, and I just hate Texas, apparently, even though I pick them to win damn near every game. But Sarkisian, according to Bartu, which I'm going to have him on because I need him to explain a lot of this stuff because people just – I don't think they believe it, Steven, because I just share his numbers. But according to Bartu, Sarkisian's only got 1 year of positive coach effect in his entire track record. So – again, I question all these lists, and I question them all off season. You can go check it out. This is where I guess is where the Texas hate comes from. But all these lists that have Sarkisian and yours included, Steven, I'm throwing you in this mix as well, that had Sarkisian as like a top three coach in the country. I don't know where that was coming from, other than guys we had up there retired or went to the NFL. So naturally, someone's got to jump that list, but. I think he's overrated.
He won't rank in the top three this year. I can assure you that. I will defend Sark some here. I do think from when he took over Texas, they are in a much better spot. The fact that they had those back-to-back playoff appearances this year was obviously a massive disappointment. You could also look at it and go, hey, they did kind of gain some steam down the stretch. They probably shouldn't have needed like a late goal line stand to beat Kentucky in overtime to beat Mississippi State. But if you wanted the most generous interpretation is you had a young quarterback and it took him a long time. You had your offensive line. You whiffed on a few guys, but you still won 25 games over the previous 2 years. So I think there's been enough growth there to make me think that they're not that far off from getting back to the playoff and then pushing for a national championship. The other thing is, Mike, we are in a very weird space where, like you said, we did see Saban retire. You know, we've seen a lot of turnover among the coaching ranks. There's been a lot of kind of volatility on coaching is one of those things. And so you get into like a lot of questions like, is Dan Lanning ready to take that next step? Like James Franklin clearly wasn't this year at Penn State. So it is a coaching group that's got probably Kirby Smart and Ryan Day 1 and 2, maybe Cignetti 3 after that. And certainly like there's a lot of volatility in there. So I guess maybe to some extent the new era of college football has made it maybe a little harder for us to judge some of these coaches and because rosters and everything is just so one year transactional.
Mm-hmm. Well, hey, speaking of transactional, I did want to get your thoughts on this as well, Stephen. So nothing official, shout out Plain Truth, was just, he's going right where I'm going here. The South Florida quarterback entered the portal, Brown, mm-hmm. Byron Brown, I think it is.
Yeah.
So, I put this out there on Twitter. I was just sharing, and everybody was like, well, yeah, Captain Obvious. But literally, Golish is telling the players there that he's bringing this guy in. So, I guess he's headed to Auburn. What do you think that does for Auburn? And again, their quarterback room is essentially Deuce Knight right now and no one else. And it's not official, but I think Deuce Knight is leaving because he wants to play. I mean, that's kind of what you got to do if you're a quarterback. You got to see the field. What's your thoughts on Brown and thoughts on Deuce Knight potentially leaving Auburn?
Did I read that right, that it was a removal from Instagram?
That's always the first sign these players do it, you know?
Right. Don't you love the tea leaves that we have to, like, dive into sometimes? It's like, did he remove, like, from the IG? Like, you see this in the NFL, too. He wants a trade. He removes all the team photos from the IG account. Mike, I think I go back to one thing with the quarterbacks, and I would say do not be surprised at any quarterback moving around because, you know, I've looked at the data the last couple of years. I think 3 years now, it's been 50 to 60% of teams in college football start transfers. So odds are your team's probably going to start a transfer at some point in the next couple of years. The other thing is, and Mike, I'm sorry to say this, you may hang up on me. I think Mario Cristobal's probably got it right at Miami, that you build offensive and defensive lines pretty much homegrown, and then you go get a quarterback in the portal. They're going to do it again this year. I mean, they had Carson Beck. They had Cam Ward. You know, they're not afraid to pay the money to go get those guys. And so I think that's pretty much the right way to do it now. That's kind of the formula we've been seeing. I think on Byron Brown specifically, I love the fit. I mean, he's done it the Golish's offense the last couple of years. He was hurt last season. They sputtered as a result of it, but he came back healthy this year. And you could argue for a good chunk of the season, they were probably the best G5 team in the country. And so you take a guy who's played a lot of ball in this system, day one starter, he comes in. It's not a, you're not going to need a kind of a lead up time. It's kind of like Mateer and Arbuckle coming in. I love the fit. I love his playmaking ability. His throwing motion could be a little funky at times, but he's also pretty good. He averaged, I think, over 8 yards a play, which is among the best in the country this season. So I will make a bold prediction that regardless of who Auburn has a quarterback, my guess is they are going to be significantly better on that side of the ball this year. And that could be Golish and Byron Brown teaming up next year.
Oh, hey, I forgot. I meant to ask you this when we were talking Texas. Let's go potentially back to them for a second. But you mentioned the new running backs coach. So he came from Florida. So now there's a big battle going on right now behind the scenes. Jaden Ball, Florida, Texas. I've even heard Ohio State. Where do you think is the best fit for Jaden Ball?
Man, that's a good question. Baxter transferred from Texas, and I think do we think Wisner's coming back next season?
I thought he declared already. I could be wrong.
That's a good question. I think in the bigger picture, I think here, what is exactly, if you're Jaden Ball, what does Florida, first of all, Buster Faulkner as a coach can find ways, I think, creatively to get Jaden Ball a bunch of opportunities next season. So I suspect that if he comes back, he will probably be the focal point. And also I would watch Aaron Filo, the transfer from Georgia Tech at quarterback. He might be a fit for Florida next year too. If you want to look at terms of just where you're probably going to make the biggest impact, it's probably going to be a place like Texas next season. Because, I mean, I think they've got to improve the run game next year. I assume that, you know, part of this Muschamp and Sark evaluation this offseason is going to be, how do we improve toughness? How do we get back to running the ball? How do we play the better overall in the line of scrimmage? And some of that is like getting a back like Jaden Ball, who can be really physical in those moments. So it feels like Texas is probably the spot that could benefit the most from him. I think Florida might be a little bit of a rebuild next year. Is that fair?
Yeah. And I think the ability to play with Arch too.
Yeah.
A running back paired with a good quarterback, you know, you get a lot more balance. So, I mean, it makes sense, but I do like it. I prefer, I'm a little old fashioned that way, I guess, but I prefer guys to, if they can, have their whole career in one spot, you know? But I don't blame anyone for thinking the grass is greener elsewhere.
Especially for a running back where you have such a small window. If you're not like someone like Derrick Henry, who can play like 15 years in the NFL and have like 250 carries, you know, right. You know, if you have to maximize that value. And so, yeah. And also Mike too, one other thing too, is there's something to being like the guy at a place like Florida and toting the rock and having a chance to maybe be the Heisman Trophy candidate. Whereas if you go to Texas, let's just say Wisner comes back, you tandem those two, you each have 100 something carries, you save some wear and tear. It's kind of like what Ohio State did with Judkins and the year before. They kind of paired him up and they ended up winning the national title. So you have two backs to share the carries, you keep them fresh, you save some wear and tear on the body for the NFL too.
Yeah. What? And then again, back to my old fashionedness, Stephen. There is value and forever being known as a guy from one school.
Yeah.
You want to start businesses. I mean, again, do people care at the moment? Certainly, like Jaden Baugh, if he goes to Texas, they win the national championship, he'll probably be a legend there too. So, I mean, that could certainly happen. But, you know, there's a laundry list of players, Stephen, in this conference and really all across the country. But in this conference, I think of specifically they're always welcome back at their campuses. And I can only imagine the lifelong opportunities that come their way because they're a Vol, because they're a Gator, because they're a Rebel, because they're a Dog, you know. But
yeah,
again, I think I'm just yelling at the clouds like an old man right now.
Let me ask you about Florida next year. How steep do you think the rebuild is? Or do you think it is a kind of quick turnaround situation? Because I'm really fascinated by them to see what they might be the most interesting roster team this offseason.
I picked them to win 9 games. So what does that tell you?
Yeah.
I think they're with a quality, competent coach. I don't even know who the quarterback's going to be. But with quality coaching, I think this team is poised to be competitive immediately.
I can definitely see it. I think when I think of rebuild too, I think of rebuilt roster in this era, not necessarily let's tear it down and go to 3-9 and then go back to like 7-9 wins. I think is 40 to 50 new players. The roster is completely overhauled, which we see frequently across the sport. Should worth noting, Mike, I mean, John Summerall in his first year at Troy, I mean, they got a lot better right out of the gate. So, I would suspect that you're not going to hear a whole lot of talk from him about patience and trying to put the pieces in place and we just need more time. My guess is that the offseason roster rebuild is all going to be about trying to, like you said, get back to those 9 games. And if they hit the quarterback if they do end up getting Aaron Filo, I think they're going to be pretty salty on offense with him. I think he's a pretty nice player and then we'll see what else they can add with that.
Well, I think we're talking too much Florida. And too much the wrong UT. Let's talk to real UT, Steven. Shout out Logan, BFL Logan B. Just picked up some Tennessee legend. Hell yeah, thank you, Logan. Do you think Heupel is on track to make Tennessee an elite program? They just had their best signing class yet, Steven. Top 5 class, I believe. New defense coordinator, Jim Knowles. Is he doing enough? Go Big Orange, says Logan. What's your thoughts on Tennessee entering the offseason?
Mike, I think the first thing that I think about is, number one, I like the Jim Knowles hire. The only thing that worries me is that track record of it taking a year or two to get this going. I do think that we won't see the complete disaster necessarily that we saw at Penn State this year. And I shouldn't use disaster. It's more of they had a very high expectation and it just didn't work out. And I think there's some variables in there like injuries and the way the season has gone that wasn't his fault. But I think if we talk about Tennessee has been to the playoff, they were in the top 25 this year. We've got a bunch of teams in the SEC that are trying to figure out on this path where they're going. And it feels like Tennessee has made the right moves to get this program kind of back to the playoff. Like getting Jim Knowles is a first step, fixing your defense, a guy who's been a top 5, top 10 defensive coordinator in the sport. I think despite those concerns about how long it takes, I think he'll get this defense turned around. And then you mentioned it. I mean, the recruiting class, potential superstar quarterback and FaZe and Brandon. You look at the skill talent and also what they did in line of scrimmage the last couple classes too. So one of those concerns that if you go back to when Heupel was hired was, can he recruit at the SEC level? I think he's done that. And I think now the question is, can you find your next superstar at quarterback? I think they probably got him in Brandon. And then what Jim Knowles can do on defense. So I think so far, I think Tennessee's made the right moves this offseason. I think the portal opens up. We'll see if they can kind of complete that process.
And do you have any thoughts on Joey Aguilar? He's trying to get a waiver. If he gets it, how much, if at all, does that change the outlook for Tennessee next year?
If I was Tennessee, I would probably bring him back. Wouldn't you? I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. If nothing else, to serve as a bridge to the younger quarterback. I think if you put Aguilar on Tennessee plus some roster development, like on defense, offensive line and stuff, I think Tennessee is probably a preseason top 25 team. I think if you're starting a true freshman, I think there's probably going to be a lot of people who probably doubt they'll be a top 25 team because they're going to look at it and go, they got a freshman quarterback. They've got a new defensive coordinator. They kind of feel like a team in transition. So feels like Aguilar might bring a little bit of a stable floor, essentially. Whereas if you're going to start Brandon from day one, the floor might be a little lower, but the ceiling is going to be pretty high once he finally kind of settles in.
Mm-hmm. And then I know we talked about this off air, Steven, so give it to him straight. Missouri hiring the wrong Chip Lindsey, offensive coordinator. I kid, but that was Cousin Shane. He said, yeah, we were hoping they would hire Chip, but Chip Kelly was the name we wanted. But thoughts on Missouri hiring old Chip Lindsey?
Chip Kelly, Bobby Petrino, one of those two would have been better, right? Mike, I will admit, and this kind of goes to our conversation about where teams are and kind of where they're going, is that, you know, losing Kirby Moore and seeing the reaction from Missouri fans, and then also seeing that, hey, this is an opportunity for Drinkwitz to upgrade at the position and take this program to the next level. I'll be honest, Mike, I'm not really a big fan of this hire. I think it's fine to some extent. You know, Chip Lindsey has been semi-productive at most of his stops, like North Carolina. Michigan this year, very limited at receiver, true freshman quarterback. He did raise the floor. You could also look at it as they bottomed out pretty bad last year. So I don't know, like, they only had one way to go this season. It also kind of feels like at times they've been able to accumulate a lot of yards, but turning that into actual production in the red zone and points on the scoreboard and winning games has been a problem. So I guess what maybe the easiest way to sum it up is it feels almost like a one-for-one swap. I don't really feel like they got a whole lot better here at offensive coordinator, which I think they kind of missed the mark on.
Mm-hmm. Well, all right. Now I've been pretty negative, so let me swing it back positive perhaps. You know, could this be a play for, again, he's a veteran, he's been around the block, knows the SEC a little. You kind of know what you're getting. You know, I can't imagine he's going to come in and just, I mean, well, could he be awful? Maybe. But I don't think he's going to come in here and be totally overwhelmed, if that makes sense. But I don't think he's going to reinvent the wheel. I don't think he's going to come in and have a, you know, like, I'm just trying to think of a name, like a Lane Kiffin for Bama or Lincoln Riley at Oklahoma. Like, he's not going to turn you into national championship contenders. But so maybe he doesn't have quite the ceiling, but he doesn't have the low, low floor. You know, could that be the thought here?
Yeah, I think you almost know what you're getting into. If you were hiring somebody who might be an up-and-comer, and somebody like me might say, hey, like that's the next rising star, and they miss on him. Whereas, you know, you go with a guy who's got a track record. He's been in the SEC. He's been a play caller at North Carolina. He's been at Michigan. Enough coaches have thought highly enough of him to hire him at these stops. The one thing I will say, in I think there's kind of like a there's a data accumulation thing that he's been able to do. Because if you work at North Carolina and you spend a season with Drake May and you help him develop for the NFL, that's a pretty good selling point. Think Bryce Underwood at Michigan too. He's a true freshman this year. Think he made progress over the course of the season, not as much as maybe Michigan fans wanted. Receivers also an issue. Like, that's a selling point too. So you've got a guy who's got a pretty solid floor. Maybe the ceiling isn't very high, but he's been around, he's called plays at a couple programs, and he's worked with some young quarterbacks and helped them develop. I think you could sell that. I don't think it's overly exciting, but like I said, I also think you know what you're getting into, and going that route as opposed to hiring somebody that's risky is very safe, if that's maybe the easiest way to put it.
Right. Any other coaching or portal news that have caught your eye since the last time we spoke?
Mike, I think staying on the Missouri thing, I was kind of surprised that Bo Prabula hit the portal. Certainly excited to see what Matt Zollers can do in the Gator Bowl. Also, is there a quarterback that maybe Missouri brings in? Kind of just felt like if Prabula came back, he'd probably be the starter next year. You also look at what Chip Lindsey's done kind of with some quarterbacks who had mobility. Maybe he didn't know that was going to be the hire, but it also feels like that would have been a pretty decent fit given the scheme. So I think Prabula entering the portal, Mike, was probably one of the things that caught my attention the most over the last week. I would also throw out enjoying the Oxford to LSU like train of coaches just going back and forth. Smith, the running backs coach, of course, now going to be at LSU. We've seen Austin Thomas, the general manager at LSU, is going to be at Ole Miss. Every day, the fascination comes to see which personnel is going to pick which side in the Kiffin versus Golding battle there.
Mm-hmm. Well, hey, Stephen, I think that we won't see you again until these bowl games to take place. And let's just stick on this Missouri theme. Missouri and Virginia in the Gator Bowl coming up Saturday evening. Any thoughts on this matchup?
Yeah, Mike, Virginia is one of the most improved teams in the country this year. And they did it by going into the portal. Chandler Morris, if you're an Oklahoma fan, you may remember that name. I think we all know who his dad is. We won't mention him. don't want to bring up any bad memories for any Arkansas fans. But Chandler Morris, they also went out and got Jamari Taylor from the FCS, a running back transfer. They added some transfers on defense. Everything has hit this season. They're much better on defense. They're much better on offense. They have walked a pretty tight rope between like turnovers and close games. So odds are this game will be close in the Gator Bowl. But also, Mike, for Missouri, I think seeing the exodus, like you've had some losses at receiver, you've got Matt Zoller starting at quarterback. It's great to see him have a full set of practices to kind of get him ready for this game. So interested to see his development and maybe see some other younger players step up for Missouri in this opportunity against Virginia.
And then speaking of LSU, we got a shell of a team here, Stephen. Good luck picking this one. Yeah. Texas Bowl, LSU, Houston. Any thoughts on this matchup?
Mike, I can make a prediction for you that I feel pretty good about. Do not expect a lot of points in this one. I think the over-under is hovering around 40 or so. I guess you could maybe see like some kind of crazy game breaking out, but both of these teams lean on their defense. And like you mentioned, there's the opt-outs, there's the transfers for LSU. It's also an old reunion with a couple friends, Mike. Connor Wigman having a great season at Houston as the starting quarterback. Also, Austin Armstrong, their defensive coordinator, their defense, ooh, one of the better ones in the Big 12. So don't expect a lot of points in this one. I like Houston to win this game just because I think they're probably closer to full strength, good defense, and Connor Wigman playing well for the Cougars this season.
Yeah. Mm. I'm glad it worked out for old Austin. It certainly didn't in Florida. And the old Connor. Yeah, I mean, he had all the talent in the world, so glad to see he's putting it together. We'll see if he does it against an SEC defense. That's the one thing LSU's got to hang their hat on is the defense.
Yeah, which I think kind of goes again to the setup for this game. It's like it is like the last bowl game on the day, so may not want to get too comfortable if the maybe a lot of punts in this one. But I do think if you're LSU, like, that's your chance to win this game, is like the defenses are going to kind of control this game. Probably not a lot of points. Can you get a turnover? Can you get kind of a splash play to maybe set your offense up? Because just given how this group is played, it's probably going to be tough for them to get consistent drives on any Saturday, but especially against a pretty solid Houston defense too.
Yeah. All right, Steven. That's all that I had planned on this episode. You got anything else before we wrap this one up?
Mike, I just want to say Merry Christmas to you. Happy holidays to you as well. Same to go to all the cousins. Have appreciated and enjoyed all of the interactions this season, all the talk about bowls and transfers and coaching. And I can't wait to do it again here soon as we get ready to talk some playoff and see where this crazy season ends up.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're going to be taking a little break here for Christmas. Wish everybody a merry, merry, merry Christmas. Hope you get everything you want. I'll share this story real quick. Shane was like, hey, I could, you know, there's a couple of things I'd like. And I got him something. It was like $400, right? And he did say thank you. And then he said, are you not giving me the $1,200 one? And I was just... I want everybody to know that's who Shane is. That's Shane, always wanting more. So shout out you, cousin Shane, you big homer. And shout out JP. Tonight, shout outs, Tolkien, Steven Up, Ted B, Jay Addison, Ed Ball, Logan B. Thank you. Merry Christmas to you all. Steven, we appreciate your contributions this year. Well, and for years to come, hopefully. That's going to do it on this episode. We'll see you on the next one. Bye-bye.
Hey, buddy, this beer's for you, Mike, and Cousin Shane. That SEC podcast loves the pirate, and the pirate loves that SEC podcast. Hail State.